Welcome to the Razor's Ink podcast with your host, Jonathan Farini. In today's voyeuristic and connected society, entertainment, and especially the incorrectly named reality entertainment, often seems to center around watching people and places with zero expectation of privacy or dignity. But what if I were to tell you that an Oscar-nominated film from 55 years ago offers a view that things haven't really changed all that much? So pour yourself a drink, pull up a chair, and hear Jonathan's take on movies, television, and today, a re-examination of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Through a 21st century lens. Here's your host, Jonathan Farini.
I saw this movie at the age of 11 upon its release in 1969. Although I grew up in the suburbs of L.A., my dad took us horseback riding, and my sister owned a couple of horses, so the title grabbed my attention.
They shoot horses, don't they?
My father grew up within the Great Depression, shared stories, so I knew the backdrop of the movie. I wasn't old enough to appreciate the pathos inside the film. This is a movie which has escaped my attention for many decades until I saw it recently. And what caught my attention is the subject of this podcast. My intent isn't to tell you about the movie, but to give you my takes and encourage you to watch it again, or for the first time. But to consider the following question carefully. What draws you to watch the carnage, misery, or humiliation of performers, regardless of media? There's no right or wrong, and no value judgment. The answer is between you and you. Yourself. I rode motorcycle dirt bikes during the 60s and 70s. My brother drove a hot rod, and we'd head out to car races, which were held every Friday night. I recall the roar of the engines echo about the foothills from the track, which was two cities away from our home. I personally enjoyed our treks out to watch demolition derby and figure eight racing. The spectacle included beat-up heavy-duty cars purposely crashing into each other until a final car was left standing. Figure 8 racing had more drama because as the cars reached the pinch point of the two ovals, remember figure 8? You'd cringe just as the cars collided or just missed each other. I recall the sound of the crash, the barking of the announcer, and smell of oil, transmission fluid, and noxious fumes from spinning tires on asphalt pavement. I don't remember safety roll bars, cages, helmets, or protective jumpsuits, just men in overalls or jeans with a t-shirt. I don't remember any ambulances racing to fetch the injured or dying, fortunately. What I was aware of at the time, and even more so today, was the demographic of the audience of which I was a member. No bougie people, but mostly guys with long hair and young women in tight jeans. I never smelled a reefer, but I seem to recall a lot of carnival-style food and beer. Maybe we call the demographic a lot of gearheads, just out on a cheap date. I don't recall the admission fee, but it was nominal to be outside in the warm Southern California evening, having a good time without any fights or rowdiness. Did I enjoy myself? Yes. Why? I don't know. I think it was the thrill of a crash, but definitely nobody to root for or any team to support. Frankly, it was just being a preteen out with my older brother, doing something he enjoyed. My brother was a master mechanic, taking apart and putting together cars, even before graduating high school. Along with his high school diploma, he got a draft card. Just saying. What about the film, Jonathan? It was produced by a television network and not a studio. My gut tells me ABC produced the film simply because there were too many great scripts floating about the movie studios. Look up the Best Picture Oscar nominations from about 1965 and right up through the end of the 70s. It was a golden age of film, and one I am fortunate to have enjoyed. We'll never see it again. Never. The film was adapted from a novel by Horace McCoy, who wrote a lot about the Great Depression. The screenwriter is a familiar name to this podcast, James Poe, who adapted Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams and Lilies of the Field. His co-screenwriter was Robert E. Thompson. It was directed by Sidney Pollack and cemented him as a tour de force in directing film. Shout out to the editor, Frederick Steinkamp, with his edits fleshing the story out with flashback and flash forwards. Beautiful. He edited the 1968 film Charlie. See my podcast. These edits are eloquent and tell more story than dozens of pages of additional script. The film ran 120 minutes, or about 120 pages. This film was nominated for 9 Oscars up and down the roster of talent, both in front of and behind the camera, with 1 win, Gig Young, Best Supporting Actor Oscar. He earned it.
Yowza, yowza, yowza! Here they are again, these wonderful, wonderful kids, still struggling, still hoping. As the clock of fate ticks away, the dance of destiny continues.
Jane Fonda plays Gloria and Michael Sarrazin plays Robert. They're partners in a marathon dance contest, which were common during the Depression. The marathon takes place in Santa Monica, California, and attracts a host of contestants seeking to be the last couple standing who will win $1,500, less expenses, mind you. Shout out to Susanna York, who plays a talented stage actress, Alice LeBlanc, replete with stunning gowns, who shows up with a handsome partner, Joel, played by Robert Fields, to catch the eye of a Hollywood talent scout, perhaps. It works out for Joel, who strands Alice without a partner. No partner, you're disqualified. It doesn't end well for Alice, who ends up underneath a running showerhead, conscious but comatose, and brilliantly and tenderly attended to by the show's promoter, Rocco, played by Gig Young. Rocco understood the misery, but in Rocco's world, the almighty dollar dictates the show must go on. The rules include dance for 1 hour and 50 minutes and get a 10-minute break. Many enter the contest simply to eat, as the dancers are fed while they dance around the stage. During the break, the men and women retreat to same-sex dorms. The women are treated by nurses smoking cigarettes and offered aspirin, and the men aren't offered anything except a face of cold water when they don't wake to the obnoxious horn ordering them out onto the floor to dance. These marathons lasted for weeks on end. Shout out to Red Buttons, who played an old retired sailor who thinks he can win but dies trying.
Once between hitches, I worked a cattle boat out of Galveston. Same thing, you know what I mean?
No, I didn't think I'd do, actually.
Well, what I mean is, if you think about it, cattle ain't got it much worse than us.
They got it better. There's always somebody feeding them.
Sure. Stuffing them up good for the slaughter pen. Right down the chute and some big dumb bohunk is standing there with a sledgehammer. Boom.
But they don't know what's gonna happen. That puts them one up on us, don't it?
Yeah. If you're thinking of it that way.
Look for a young Bruce Dern, Michael Conrad, and Al Lewis, also known as Grandpa Munster. The rules are straightforward. Keep moving. You can drag your partner, who can sleep, but the knees can't touch the floor. Referees of sorts on skates herd the dancers like wranglers. Rocco is both the promoter and master of ceremonies. It's set up like a ballroom you'd find inside a third-rate high school gym. The longer the dance marathon continues, the more tickets Rocco sells to gawkers consisting of largely elderly ladies who throw pennies at their favorite dancers while rooting them on. Others show up in black tie and tails. Who are they, and why are they there? My gut tells me they are sadists with a few bucks. Some fortunate dancers obtain sponsorships. Robert wears a beat-up sweater promoting Jonathan's Tonic. Bruce Dern plays James Bates and drags his pregnant wife, Ruby, played by Bonnie Bedelia, who is coaxed to sing a pathetic song at the urging of Rocco.
The best thing is
Wasn't that nice? Our own number 68.
Pure pathos, people. Contestants come and go. Rocco is complex. He milks the contestants for all they have, physically, mentally, and emotionally. Rocco tells us his father was a traveling faith healer, and young Rocco was his father's supposedly crippled shill, who miraculously recovers. It's a pathetic revelation by Rocco, and Gig Young's ability to play a profiteering promoter of misery, and perhaps the skills he learned from his father, helps him coax a physically and emotionally spent Alice from the shower. It's Oscar gold.
Please. I just want to help you. I just want to turn off the water, that's all. I just want to turn off them. All right, I won't. If you don't want me to. Tell me. Whatever it is, you can tell me.
Touched me.
Who?
Touched me.
Get out of here!
Is he dead?
Sailor. The sailor. No. You have my personal word, he's gonna be fine.
Someone screamed.
That was you, Alice.
Gig had been acting for decades, and this role was made for him. He wears a tuxedo and rouses the audience like a faith healer, shouting,
"Yowza, yowza, yowza!"
while pointing out the determined dancers by name and encouraging the audience to root for their favorite couple. Throughout the marathon, Rocco will, without notice, rev up the orchestra and command the dancers to race around the track. It's really a walk-run because you must hold on to your partner or drag them. It's a perverse command performance of sorts. It wasn't lost on this viewer that the tuxedo-clad orchestra was all black, who, if playing in a legit venue, would leave and enter from the back door and certainly not dine with the white guests. In this story, both the black musicians and all white dancers are scratching out a living during tough times and lucky to find work. Gloria is ready to quit literally and proverbially, but must succumb to Rocco's advances and provide a service for a favor, provided he...
Don't touch me.
I want you to ask if Gloria is Jane's Bree Daniels in Clute 2 years later in 1971, or is Bree Daniels Gloria? Strikingly familiar character performances to this viewer. Hours and days tick by, the dancers dwindle in number, but the ticket-paying audience grows larger. I won't reveal any more of the movie, but the question I was left with is what attracted the audience to watch poverty-stricken people suffer for just a glimmer of hope of winning and a hot meal? Rocco answers my question.
But why?
For the good of the show. That's what we're all interested in, isn't it? The show.
No, it's a contest. Isn't that what it's supposed to be? Isn't that what you advertised? A contest.
Not for them. For you, maybe, but not for them. You think they're laying out two bits of throat just to watch you poke your head up into the sunlight? Or Alice look like she just stepped out of a beauty parlor? They don't give a damn whether you win, or James and Ruby, or Mario and Jackie, or the man on the moon and Little Miss Muffet. They just want to see a little misery out there so they can feel a little better, maybe. They're entitled to that.
I end the podcast with a question for us all. Where do we draw the line, if any, on what we consume from media? Would you pay to watch these dancers if such a marathon showed up outside your town? Does this movie eerily remind you of some reality television programming where contestants lay it all on the line for fame and fortune?
Can arranged marriages work? Welcome to Married.
by America.
Have you ever regretted marrying your husband? You seem a little shocked, David. Was there anything you want to say?
You got a 9.5 on the body for me because at some point between the hip and the knee, your legs have to touch. There's just too big of a gap in there.
Every bride wants to look perfect on her wedding day. But some may need some extra help.
There are a lot of girls in the house who are not princess material.
But once she's chosen Mr. Right, will love last when the mask comes off? Things could get ugly.
Once, there was an average Joe who made a humble living by simply moving dirt. Meet Evan Marriott. Income, $19,000 a year.
I'm Megan Hauserman, and I am on the hunt for a man, a wealthy man.
The purpose of this episode was to get you thinking about the media you consume and why. Like the audiences of the dance marathons, are you seeking precious moments of escapism? If so, it's okay. There wouldn't be films, television, streaming, or live events if there wasn't a need to fulfill. The question remains, however, how far out on the edge will you find your brand of escapism? Jonathan of today doesn't have any interest in returning to the Demolition Derby spectacles. And for me, the more blood, guts, special effects, sex, and vulgarity, the weaker the story. Just a suggestion to fellow writers, do your best to avoid the low-hanging fruit when seeking a reader's attention. Rotting fruit can be seen and smelled a mile away by good writers. Just saying. Until I see you next time, please leave behind a soft footprint. And yowzer, yowzer, yowzer. Class is dismissed.
And to counter what Jonathan said earlier about that year's Oscars, while that era produced many Oscar-worthy films, in 1970, in my humble opinion, They Shoot Horses was robbed of several additional Oscars, at the very least, for Jane Fonda and Susanna York. You've been listening to the Razor's Ink podcast with Jonathan Farini. Be sure to check out Jonathan's collection of fiction at the Jonathan B. Farini Story Collection at jonathanfarini.com. There you'll find everything from drama to romance, something for every reader, including Jonathan's latest prose poem, King Tide, recently published by Rundalania Magazine. That's jonathanfarini.com, Farini with two R's, one N. Or drop an email to razorsincpodcast@gmail.com.